So that's why, you know, one never knows when you come back at the beginning of the year how many new people Parliament has employed. So I thought you may have been employed by Parliament. So could you come over to the left, please? My left. You're right. All right, sorry about that. So all those not members of Parliament or journalists or staff should be on the right, of my right. On everyone else on this side. My left, your right. Okay. So, anyway, it's wonderful to start off on such a nice sunny day, and I believe people in Cape Town have had quite a hot weather, so praying for rain in due course without having floods. So I hope we get that kind of rain. I can see some hands up here, but we're not taking inputs just yet. And then in terms of the committee, really one would like to welcome everyone back. And I know it's a very busy time of the year for all of us. So you are very, you know, I really appreciate you being here. And looking at the right here, I see most of the ANC members are here. We have DA represented here, as well as COPE. And would that be all the committee members? There's an apology from Dr. James and Advocate Anton Albers, Honourable James from the DA, and Honourable Albers from the Freedom Front. Who else is there? Honourable Khadebi, is Honourable Mabasi here, I believe? Apparently. I must just remind everyone that when it's legislation, they come to legislation as a priority, and I'm sure the relevant whips will see to that, and not on oversight. Having said that, I do have one or two words I'd like to make this morning, very briefly, and that is, it's a very important piece of legislation that we've got in front of us. It's one of those that can truly be transformative, can actually radically change our economy and move us in the direction that we would like it to move since 1994. I think we're all well aware that the indebtedness of a number of South Africans and the impairment of debt, particularly in the majority of the population who earn the least, is having a severe impact on the quality of their lives. Now, it is not the intention of the committee to try and destroy a banking system. It is the intention of the committee to examine and study the legislation before us and try to ensure that we bring about robust legislation that is equitable, that was fair, that is economically efficient and truly impacts positively on the socio-economic environment of our country. So I do hope that we'll all apply our minds in that particular manner. Also, what I do know that we've got here, but perhaps the sheets of paper have gone, before us here we have a number of stakeholders, including the department. We've got I know from DTI, the Department of Trade and Industry, we have the DDG, Ms. Zordwa, in two. Ms. Zordwa in Thule. I thought someone was responding to that outside the door. And I know that you'll introduce the rest of your direct team, the DTI. I can see the chief director here as well. Chief Director Nancy Denzi is also with us. Is there anyone else directly from your department, Ms. Ntuli?
Thanks, Chair, and good afternoon. Chair, we do have a number of people. Specifically, I just want to bring to your attention, Chair, that we have brought our new chief directors and also new directors that have joined the department. That's basically for their orientation and introduction to Parliament in this process. But we've got the names there. If the Chair would like me to go through that, or they can be done through.
We would appreciate, I've never been too good at reading hieroglyphics. So if you would just kindly introduce your team.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, as you have already alluded, I've got the Chief Director here for Policy and Legislation, Mr. McDonald Nechitenzi. And we have also our new Chief Director for Legislative Drafting, that is Dr. Ria Nonyana Mokabani. She's still outside. And yes, and we've got our new chief director as well for market research and trend analysis, that is Evelyn Masoja. She's also, okay, the two ladies are coming through. Sorry, Chair, for that. I didn't notice they were still outside. Those are the two chief directors that have joined the department in the division. So when we indicated that we'll be expanding the capacity so that we can then deal effectively with the work of this parliament, this is what we meant, and we have brought, and Chair, it's not a boys' choir anymore. Yes. And then there's Chipiwa Mabutugu. He's a regular. That's our director for legislative drafting. And we've got our new director for legislative drafting, another one, which is Mr. Nelson Matibe. And we also have another one, which is Ms. Zodwa Matiwane. I can't see her. Okay. There. We're just diluting the boys' choir. And Chair, we've got our regular as well, Mr. Andy Sapotwana, who's been the person working on this project specifically and tirelessly so, under support honor. And we've got our director for regulatory impact assessment, that is Mr. Surprise Tusaho. Chair, I will leave it at that, hoping that I didn't leave any of the people that I've come with today. But I just want to indicate that we have our regulators here. The CEO for the National Credit Regulator, Ms. Nomsa Mosahari, is here. She's got a team with her, and she can, I think she the names have been provided to Andre. But I think she, if you can allow the opportunity for her to just introduce her team. But we also have the National Consumer Tribunal, which is also represented by Ms. Hazel Devrash, and she's also accompanied by some of the team members. Thanks, Chair.
I think we, Treasury are on their way, but unfortunately we can't wait. for them, but we do have other work to come in before them, and that is the input which I've already made, and then by the researcher, Ms. Zakwanda Madalani, who will also be making a short input here. Maybe if you can, sort of bring your laptop up here, it's going to be a lot better. While Ms. Zakwanda is just quickly bringing her laptop to the front here to brief us all. Yes, I just wanted to finish my sentence. Honourable.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Now, I thought we had a brief gap while we were waiting for a laptop to arrive. Madam Chair, I haven't got an agenda. Is there? I got an SMS, but I haven't got our normal sort of agenda. Okay, thank you.
It's fine. I think it's sometimes what happens the first meeting of the year. Things are left on the side. Right, on that particular note, Treasury, whoever comes is making a presentation, occupies about 4 seats in the front. For the rest of the time, these seats can be filled. It's not, we only utilize 3 or 4 of them. So you've got a huge gap here in front, and some of you we can't even see. You've almost gone into the back benches there. So I'm not sure how that came about, and this was mistaken for the local church. But here we are. Can you, Mr. Kwanda, can you start, please?
Thank you, Chairperson. Afternoon, honorable members, and afternoon to everybody present. In light of the proposed amendments in legislation, the Chairperson has asked me to look at legislation from other countries and in government interventions in terms of credit and where consumers are indebted. And in looking in these countries, I was given 5 countries, which is France, Iceland, Ireland, United States, and to come back home to South Africa, and to look at interventions that government use to ensure that customers or consumers or households get relief when they are indebted, or when there are other matters related to credit, they are relieved in terms of that. This is some of the measures that are found that government has used in the past. One is debt restructuring, which is, I'm sorry, it's not on the screen. Which is debt restructuring, and we use that in South Africa, and it's most famously known as debt canceling process, which is one of the approaches, which is very well known in South Africa. A second approach is an approach which is, I think it's more radical, and it's used by governments, where it's financed by governments. Which means that if consumers are very indebted and there's mortgages that they can't pay back, governments would take the decision to buy those mortgages from the banks and offer them to consumers or households at lower repayment terms or at longer periods. Those are only used, it should be cautioned, those are only used by governments who are fiscally sound and where the economy is very stable and there's growth in the economy, because those might have unintended implications in the future. A third approach that is used is an administrative approach. The administrative approach does not necessarily affect the indebtedness. However, it's used to address other matters that are related to debt or credit, which affect the consumer or the household. I would classify the removal of credit information as an administrative approach, because as much as it addresses problems that are related to credit or debt, it does not directly affect indebtedness. It would address other measures,
such as issues that are related to employment or issues that are related to rental or accommodation. Those are the three measures that have been used. In this kind of legislation, South Africa has not gone the route of as far as being radical or more aggressive legislation, because in doing that, in taking a more radical approach, you need to ensure that other infrastructure is in place and other requirements are met. For example, as I mentioned earlier, I mentioned a good fiscal space and a good economic conditions should prevail, should a government decide to go that approach. This is just an overview of government interventions that have been used in other countries. Iceland last year, which is 2013, proposed a financed approach to government intervention, which means because their households are indebted, they would buy the mortgages from the bank and offer them to the households at reduced rates or longer repayment terms to assist that. That approach has its pros and cons, which should be taken into account. And in doing it, in taking a decision to intervene in the market, it should be understood that there are pros and cons. And in that, most of the cons that have been highlighted is that when that happens, when government decides to take a decision to intervene, households tend to relax. Default is one of the problems that, or challenges that have been highlighted, that consumers tend to default in saying, I can default knowing that if I can't pay, I've proven that I can't pay my mortgage, government will assist. And in any kind of legislation, the impact on both the creditor and the household is very important. I think that's all I had to say. Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Ms. Madalani. Just remain there for a moment. I know that this is ready, but there have been problems with SOFTIS starting on the administration side, on the other side. So we are getting copies made, committee. I know some of you have indicated to me that you'd like a copy. This document is about 16 pages long, or 9 pages, and it will be made available to you today. I hope that's in order. That's the research input. It's a far more valuable document than what it may appear to have been, and I think what Ms. Madalani tried to point out, we're not the first country to be dealing with this. Many countries have attempted and have utilized state intervention, some more radically than others. And it's up to us to be aware of that as we examine our own legislation in this particular regard. So, Ms. Madalani, if you would just work with Mr. Hermans to try and get some copies made. Thank you very much again.
Sorry,
there aren't questions to her now, no, because you've got you haven't got the copy. That's the problem. But do you want to ask something else, Honourable Salam?
No. Just wanted to ask her to repeat the two interventions. I can remember one where government buys over the debt and make the people pay with lower interest or for a longer time. But the first one I missed.
Repeat that sentence, please, Ms. Madalani.
Yes. The first approach is debt restructuring, which we know in South Africa as the debt cancelling process, where you would approach a debt canceller and say, I might be unable to pay off my debt. And during that evaluation process, to ensure that you are or you aren't able to repay your debt, and there will be negotiations between the debtor and the creditor to negotiate new terms. That's the one. Another one, I said it's an administrative approach where it does not really affect the indebtedness of the consumer or the household. It addresses other measures or other matters that relate to credit or debt. Thank you. And I gave an example of the removal of credit information, which I believe it's an administrative approach. Thank you.
It's in greater detail in this 9-page document, and we will be hearing more about that each morning when we tackle this. It applies to all of us here who wouldn't have done the research, you know, the research on this matter. So once again, Sekwanda, just work with Mr. Hermans to get copies of this document made. We can get 20 copies, please. Thank you very much. Thank you, Honourable Mabasa. We knew you were in Parliament, but we didn't know where. Okay, thank you. Right, we've now got National Treasury with us, and National Treasury is represented here by the DDG, Mr. Mamoniat, and his colleague, I'm not sure of the title, Mr. Mangoi. Yes, I'm just not sure of the title itself, but I'm sure Mr. Mamoniat will deal with those aspects. So we can go straight into Treasury's presentation. Does everyone have it? Right. And by the way, everyone can get a copy of this. We're just having problems with the printer. Thanks. Over to you, Mum.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you for inviting me. And let me confess, this is not a problem of the printer. It's more like just-in-time production. We are making copies as well, so they are. So let's not kill a tree. There should be enough, surely. Chair, thank you for inviting me. And let me say, it was a bit hard to get away from the office, given we have the budget. So I think not trying to deal with all the issues. I think just to be clear, I think that in coming here, I think some of the issues that we wanted to deal with, I think, was broadly to have two objectives. I think in this presentation, I think just to provide a broader perspective of the overall policy framework that's been adopted by Cabinet to reform the regulation of the financial sector. Following the 2008 global financial crisis, you see GFC all over, stand for global financial crisis. It was really a paradigm shifting event that we either have been lucky or unlucky to have lived through. Otherwise, you would have just heard about it, like what happened in the time of your, probably your grandparents or our grandparents in the 1930s. I think that within that, just to situate that, you know, what the lessons are from the crisis, because as I said, it did shift paradigms in how people saw the need to regulate the financial sector, particularly up to 2008. The kind of approach you got condemned if you even tried to regulate the sector, and the approach was all about light touch regulation. Today, fortunately, nobody talks about light touch. I've gotten in trouble in Parliament for saying, we proudly say it's draconian legislation, like Section 6 of the Terrorism Act in the old days. And that has become the internationally accepted way of regulating the financial sector. Secondly, I think within that, just to explain the financial stability objective, because the financial sector has a lot of benefits, and in a sense it's like a nuclear facility. Lots of benefits if you regulate it properly, but you know, you only need one mistake, one explosion, and you see exactly what we've seen in 2008, that we are still trying to recover from that crisis. And very few countries today have the GDP or jobs back at the levels they were in 2008. That's not even talking about growth. What would have happened had we grown during that period? I think I'll come and talk about Twin Peaks and the setting up of two regulators. So that's the first objective, just so that you get the broader context here. Sure. You can call me Momo Chair, it's fine. The second objective of the presentation is to provide, is to indicate government's policy with regard to the problem of over-indebted households. Certainly in December, the government actually approved the bill to implement Twin Peaks. It's out for public comment. It approved it for publication to take comment. And secondly, also approved a whole set of measures that government wants us to work on jointly with other departments and regulators, including the DTI. Now, I think that when the NCRA amendments were done, these two memos had not served with the cabinet yet, so we now have the task of obviously seeing how they all fit together. So, and that really gets to the third aim, is to really situate where does this process fit within those objectives, which in a sense, one of which has been really determined later. And I guess always take a step back and try and understand what problems are we trying to solve with the current problems, what problems are we not solving with the current amendments, and how do we deal with potentially conflicting objectives. That's not just in those amendments. I mean, even with Twin Peaks, on one hand you want to make sure that the financial sector is safer, that a bank doesn't go bust, because that, as we've seen, can even not just cause problems for the depositors, but can create a systemic crisis which affects the entire financial sector, and worse, also affects the entire economy. People lose their jobs. So in a sense, there's a lot of, in economic terms, it's described as a moral hazard problem. The financial sector knows that, or some players believe that they can do what they want, that they can take risks. And to the extent that the risks emerge, the losses are socialized, government is forced to intervene. Of course, when they make profits, the profits are, privatized. So you have this asymmetry in the sector. And of course in South Africa, given that we're a developing country, I think the issue of access, or as we call, say, financial inclusion, how do you get the financial sector to serve poorer communities, is a big issue and important an objective. And whilst there may not always be in conflict, there are times when they could potentially be. I think, let me start by just saying that I think National Treasury supports the direction of the amendments in the NCA amendment bill, largely because I think, and in fact we feel that the National Credit Act actually is a very important act of Parliament. We all know that credit is very important for the economy, particularly if you want economic growth and jobs. It drives consumption, it drives investment, generates jobs in the process. But of course, that doesn't mean that all credit is good. There is some bad credit, and certainly the Act has identified reckless loans. And these are bad not just for the households, but for the economy as a whole, because those, when people are over-leveraged or over-indebted, they're unable to spend. It creates all kinds of problems, including, as you said, not that I've done any work on that or can prove it, but a lot of the instability on the mines, particularly around Marikana, have been driven by the fact that many of the miners are over-indebted, and that's a so creates all kinds of socio-economic problems that you need to deal with, we as a country need to deal with. So we definitely support, I think, the bill's intentions to define and limit reckless lending better, introducing affordability criteria, introducing fit and proper standards for debt counselors, supervising your payment distribution agencies, removing certain bottlenecks and loopholes that have had unintended consequences, particularly in a debt counseling process. So I think broadly we support it, but I think with anything in the financial sector, and that's not just this legislation, you could pose the same questions for the bill that we've put out for public comment on Twin Peaks. The key question is always, are these amendments or these reforms, do they go far enough? Should they not go further? At what point should they go further? Because you can't have everything in place before you put legislation forward. And particularly, are they intrusive enough? As I said, I use the word draconian. Okay, the words of the IMF, the words of, if you go to the G20, the words that I use is intrusive supervision. Okay. That has now become the international way of regulating the financial sector. I think that there's always broader questions. Do the amendments protect customers more effectively from reckless lending practices? So will the bill actually achieve what it's intended to achieve? Particularly since, and when I deal with the problem of over-indebtedness, that you see that in a sense, the fact that we have an over-indebtedness problem actually means that we as a country have failed to rein in the problem. The problem actually got worse in the last few years. So we need to obviously take a critical look at ourselves and say, why has the problem gotten worse in the last few years? Whilst the National Credit Act took effect much later, I think it was in 2007, the fact of the matter is the problem has got worse over the last few years, even after the Act took effect. It was early days, but so we need to just, I think, analyze and understand what the problems have been. Well, I think a particular question we have, and certainly when Cabinet looked at it, is will the amendments allow us to set really tough standards on what we call payday lenders? Very happy to see you have some payday lenders coming here, Chair. I hope you ask them very hard questions. For those of you who are Anglicans, you'll see how the church in the UK has actually led the charge against what they call payday lenders. These are people who lend you money when you run short and give it to employed people, and when it's payday, they expect you to pay the loan. The problem, the interest rates are extremely high, and in fact, if you look at the UK, not only do they are they beginning to limit the interest, they also begin to limit the number of times you can renew this loan, because in effect you take up this loan every month. And I think certainly in the discussion, I think Cabinet felt very strongly that we need to be even more than draconian with payday lenders, because it really is a form of enslavement of people, particularly in a low-income market. They've got very nice websites, if you go, very nice TV adverts, but frankly, their practices are disgraceful. And in fact, we would like to look at how you can actually criminalize some of the ways in which these lenders operate. I think the whole point too is that licensing should be not just have tougher fit and proper requirements. In the financial sector, you don't have the right to provide financial services. You have to be fit and proper. And this should include setting aside capital, which of course happens with banks, insurance companies. In other words, you've got to have some skin in the game. Otherwise, people create more problems and run away from the problems. So I think when we look at this, certainly the questions that we would ask is how do the NCA amendments fit into the broader reform package, because the NCA was passed in 2005, which was before the global financial crisis. And there's no doubt that in 2005, the Act was ahead of its time. Very few countries regulated credit in this way, household credit. It was ahead of its time. But we shouldn't fool ourselves. Other countries have moved on after 2008. They've actually got all kinds of new legislation. And the problem for us is that generally, our current financial laws have actually been left behind. And so we do need to amend these laws, not just the NCA, but certainly all our financial sector legislation, if we are to even keep up with other countries. And I think the G20 chair is quite important to take note, because after the financial crisis, the G20, in fact, established, it used to be just a forum of ministers of finance, but from 2008, at the time President Bush actually convened the leaders of the country, and that's been held twice a year, a heads of state summit. And a lot of their focus has been on fixing up the financial sector. And of course, the problem that you have is that the financial sector is actually operates, it's more globally integrated than any other sector. Money can move from one country to the other in nanoseconds, yet they are regulated on a country-by-country basis, nationally. So therefore it means you know, when Lehman fell, they took away the money from the UK very quickly. How do you actually ensure that your two countries work together and they sort out how to resolve a banking crisis? So getting regulators to work with each other across national borders is a challenge at the best of times. When there's a crisis, it's every country for themselves. So global standards have been set. And Chair, I think an important word to know now is the word Sufis. Now, I've said this joke a million times. It's not exactly what you think it is. It stands for systemically important financial institutions. And if you look at the global standards that apply, you have a list of, I think it's under 30 of your major banks and some non-banks. So any bank you can think of, bank, the big ones, Barclays, Bank of America, Deutsche Bank, they are all regarded as global SIFIs. And they have the toughest regulations on them. And they are called global SIFIs because when you saw Lehman fall, it caused a global crisis. Okay. So not only does it mess up all the other banks, and the US Fed had to intervene to save the other banks in the US system, they also had to intervene to save the US economy. And in a sense, whilst you had recession, if there's no doubt that these interventions were not there, you would have had not just a recession, you would have had a very deep depression. So I think you would have heard certainly that there's new global standards, it's a lot in the news, Basel III. And South Africa, certainly, if you want your financial institutions to operate, we need our banks, for example, to be able to transact with banks in other countries. Otherwise, you can't have trade that easily. So South Africa, we published a document in 2011. It was approved by Cabinet. And that laid the basis where Cabinet had approved the the shift towards twin peaks. And we had a period of 2 years of technical work, and that has culminated now in a bill. It's not called a Twin Peaks bill, it's called something like the Financial Sector Regulation Bill. It is available on the Treasury website. And I'll explain that in a while. I think it's important to see how the NCA relates to the Twin Peaks system as a whole, and how do the NCA amendments also deal with household indebtedness. So I'm going to just talk about Twin Peaks. I'm not going to go through the slide in detail. I've talked about this, that the G20 leaders met after the global financial crisis. In fact, South Africa was then accepted in a multinational body called the Financial Stability Board, the FSB, not to be confused with South Africa's own Financial Services Board. Okay, this is the Stability Board. It's a multinational body, and together with the IMF, they've been leading the charge on how to, for example, get the Basel Committee to set higher standards, how to get IOSCO to have higher standards for securities or stock exchange, stocks, securities markets. And you have the International Association for Insurance, IAIS, so this body brings all the regulators and what they call systemically important countries with systemically important financial sectors to come together. And there's been a lot of work done on financial stability. In fact, if you have the time, I would just Google Financial Stability Board and look at some of their papers. So aside from Basel III, they've made sure that derivatives now are no longer over the counter, but that largely they'll go through an exchange. The one other area they're working on is shadow banking, and I'll come to that. South Africa, through that process, is committed to regular peer reviews. We get peer reviewed for money laundering, our anti-money laundering legislation. We get peer reviewed through what's called the FSAP, which the IMF and World Bank conduct every 5 years, and we have one coming now in 2014. We get peer reviewed then even by the Financial Stability Board in between the IMF World Bank reviews to see that we're implementing the recommendations that are set. This has become almost like a kind of license for you to operate globally. If you don't pass those tests, people will put all kinds of hurdles and other requirements if your financial institutions want to deal in other countries. They've also tried to reduce the scope for regulatory arbitrage. The financial sector is very good. If there's two regulators or two bits of legislation, they know how to flow in between and avoid the spirit of the legislation. And to actually, one of the biggest problems in a financial crisis was the fact that the regulators, even within a country, wouldn't work together. And that's almost a natural thing. Every regulator looks at just their job. They don't care what everybody else does, even in the same country, okay? They wouldn't do it between countries, and they don't share information. And in fact, one has to take pretty strong steps, like say here in South Africa, to make sure the National Credit Regulator, Banking Supervision, Financial Services Board, FIC, you name it, that all of them work closely together. And don't hide under secrecy, that I can't tell you that because my law says I can't reveal to you. One needs a whole different way of regulators working together. So I won't go through all these slides here. I've just said what the financial stability does. It sets international standards, it monitors, does its peer reviews, and ensures coordination. South Africa has largely, through the president, committed to these resolutions. So if you go onto the G20 website, you'll see the resolutions that have been taken. I could certainly make these available. I've already said what Twin Peaks is. The Pearl actually mandates the Reserve Bank to protect financial stability of the entire system within a framework agreed with government. And that's what we call macroprudential supervision. And then you have what's called microprudential supervision, so that's your prudential regulator. At the moment, we only have banking supervision. So the Financial Services Board has been broken up. The insurance regulators that look after the insurance sector, for example, will move over to the SARB. And they will look at prudential safety. Prudential refers to safety. Is your bank safe? Is your pension fund safe? Will your pension fund not collapse in 2 years' time to start work? And will it in fact pay you in 40 years' time when you retire and after you've retired? Are your deposits safe in a bank? Okay. So you often say the prudential regulators are like doctors. They're not out there to catch you. they look for a patient who's sick, and they look at how to fix the patient up. They're not going to ask how you got sick. On the other hand, you have the market conduct regulator. So the financial services board will be phased out and replaced by the market conduct regulator. They look at customer protection and how financial services conduct their business. Now, why is it more than customer protection? Because if you take a pension fund, the timing, some financial transactions can be completed in nanoseconds, but some, like your pension fund, could be 60, 80 years, okay, when it does its final payout from the time you start contributing. So it's not like buying a vacuum cleaner, which if you buy it doesn't work, you know, you go back to the store and you change it. You've got to know this thing's going to work, and that's why the financial sector needs to have much higher standards to protect customers. Secondly, financial companies have to conduct their services ethically. So we are saying when they deal with retail customers, there'll be minimum norms and standards in effect set for their contracts with you. The chances are that banks have good lawyers, they will always be right. So when you have a dispute, that you need to have systems like the Ombud, you need to ban certain practices, and if you don't do that, it doesn't matter what's in the contract, they are forced to comply with those standards. I've talked about the other things, I'll move on. I think that if you look at the current regulatory climate in South Africa, it's very fragmented, as I said. I mean, let's take credit. It's regulated by the NCR when it comes to individuals, but deposits is done by banking supervision. So 90% of your lending is done by banks. Okay. The one side of the balance sheet is regulated by the SARB, Reserve Bank. The other side is regulated by the NCR. Do the regulators talk to each other? It's a question you should always ask of all regulators. Okay. Especially that it's the same balance sheet. But it gets worse. Most financial institutions are conglomerates. So if you look at Absa, Standard Bank, they do banking deposits, they do lending, they do insurance, they do asset management. So the financial services board regulates some things. Some things are regulated by the SARB. It's actually a very complex problem. How do you actually regulate them effectively? Because if the regulators aren't talking, the insurance business can go bust, and that could affect the bank. How do you deal with those issues? And this is not just a South African problem. This is a worldwide problem that you have. In addition, the national payment system, it should be NPS, that is the NP authority, regulates the payment system. So the key...
Who regulates the payment system?
The South African Reserve Bank. So access to that payment system. Not all payment system. We've said to them, in the current system where you get a lot of web-based systems and others, there's a lot of gaps in these systems. So in fact, when we were doing Twin Peaks, the one issue is, what are the gaps in your regulatory system? So at the moment, there's a process to close all the gaps. And I think the two points...
Lewis, I will take inputs a bit later. I just didn't hear that.
No, I'm just asking for clarity as well. I need an acronym check.
Sure.
An acronym? You haven't got your iPad here, okay?
No, sorry. There's three. What is FSAP, BSD, and FIC?
Okay. FIC is a Financial Intelligence Center. It's a regulatory authority whose job is to... BSD is the Banking Supervision Department, which is in the South African Reserve Bank, the SARB, and
FSAP.
FSAP is the Financial Sector Assessment Program. That's what the IMF and World Bank do.
I think everyone here, because there were several other little abbreviations, which some may know and others don't, be useful more if you just ask someone in your department to send a half a page to the
very long, but I'll do that.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Okay. I think that's one of the, so the key issues are, you know, the need for joint coordinated approach across departments and the regulators that depend, report to those ministers who head the department, and the need for better coordination and cooperation between all financial sector regulators. FSB here is a financial services board to regulate credit more effectively. Okay. You could also put in the National Payment Authority, because as you'll see with the credit abuses, how the payment system allows debit orders is one of the biggest abuses that you have in the current system. So Cabinet has approved this. I should add that two other objectives, which I'm not going to deal with today, is you always need to deal with financial crime. In fact, you would have seen that on money laundering, Standard Bank was fined by the UK authority earlier this week. So if our banks don't actually comply with those high standards, you find that other countries will actually fine them. So the financial sector is a very difficult place, and in fact the regulators here don't do their job. They expose them to bigger fines, to be paid in dollars or pounds to some other authority elsewhere. So it's quite important that the people here are quite buckled and, you know, and act when they have to act. And that's why I think your regulators have to be operationally quite independent, yet work in a coordinated way. And the last objective, of course, for South Africa is financial inclusion, which is a question of access. I won't deal with it here, but just to make the point that if you look at the subprime crisis, not very different from demands that we had, that you want to target loans to the low-income group for mortgages, for housing, it's a very good intention. But if people can't pay it, it was actually those subprime housing loans was the trigger that caused the UK problem. So it shows you how a market conduct problem, how an access issue, could itself become a trigger for the kinds of problems that you've seen. And that's why when you're dealing with a nuclear facility like the financial sector, you've got to handle with care. And act when you see a bolt that's there, you need to act and not make a phone call to the minister or to somebody to say, can I act because the bolt is here? Because speed is of the essence. You need to move. These are just nice pictures to show you the Twin Peaks. There aren't really two peaks. I just want to make the point, Twin Peaks is not one or two authorities, it's a system. And I think that's important because to understand, and I'll say this in a moment. It's been established slowly because you don't want to rush and have new institutions that don't function. It will take a few years to set. We're hoping to put the legislation through at the end of the year, after the elections, and get them to start taking effect next year. But the old regulators will be phased out slowly. I think it's important, just for your information, that the Financial Stability Board review is available. They did have some strong views on the fact, on the lack of coordination between the various regulators. They had strong views on, whilst they were supportive of Twin Peaks, they had strong views about how the NCR should relate to the Twin Peaks system. And in fact, government does need to consider these recommendations, and in fact will, I guess, finally only respond when we have the legislation, especially since we have the FSEP. So, we are going to wait for public comments as well now that the bill is out. And so when I talk of the system, I mean, the system, if you go back, it could be the fact that you have one financial services tribunal rather than have every activity having its own tribunal. You have a whole system of ombuds that you have, okay. The whole issue there is should we not bring all, there's a banking ombud, credit ombud, insurance ombud, the pension ombud is called So, you know, you've got various names and you've got a FICE ombud as well. So they're all the same conceptually the same, and I think we've got too many ombuds. There's probably some scope to harmonize. I think that one of the key problems with regard to credit that you should keep in mind is the Financial Stability Board is looking at what they call shadow banks. Shadow banks are your non-banks banks, so they quake like a duck, they look like a duck, they flap like a duck. So they're saying that as the banking sector has been regulated more heavily, that a lot of this sort of banking type activity has been taken up by shadow banks, okay? And in South Africa, as you know, of the whilst 90% of your lending is from the banks, there's at least 5,500 credit providers. This is using the, of course, the NCR's figures. So most of them may not take deposits, but the question is, if you look at their activities, there's a concern that in the financial sector, there's a lot of interconnections. You may well find that there's a bank that's standing behind a credit provider. Okay, so if that goes bust, it could impact on the bank. So how do you deal with these risks? So there is a need to look at prudential supervision. Of course, the NCR focuses on more market conduct, sort of customer protection issues and not the prudential issues. So I think, just to sum up, I think the point is that I think for all your regulators in the financial sector, one needs to understand how they fit within the financial stability system. In fact, as a Treasury, we feel quite strongly that there are some gaps in the current bill that we should compel that the regulators work together and certainly protect financial stability. It doesn't make sense that you might go for someone who's clearly transgressing the law, and in going for them, you could spark a financial crisis. So we just need to be smarter about how do you then act against such a systemically important financial institution. I mean, if you look at the classification today, we don't have any global SIFIs, even though Barclays is one, but, you know, it's EBSA here or Barclays now, as they call themselves. But our banks here are ring fence, and they are definitely domestic SIFIs. I mean, the big four definitely are. You don't have whatever way you define them. If one of the big banks goes, you can be certain there'll be a huge crisis in our country. So it's always important to make sure that they are prudentially safe. And I think for all of these reasons, issues like working cooperatively, reducing the scope of regulatory arbitrage are all very important and so on. I want to just deal with the second part, which is the other initiative that Cabinet started, is obviously household indebtedness. And there the essential question, I think, to ask is, how do the NCA amendments protect the customer better? We think that it does because of the fit and proper dealing with PDAs, trying to find mechanisms for making sure the PDAs don't run away with your money when you start paying, etc., etc. But there are broader issues there as well. So I think the issue is how financial institutions conduct their business. Certainly, I think when you look at credit, some of the practices have been disgraceful. I think Minister Davies, when he certainly took on the whole issue of unsecured lending, I think that was an important issue to take up. And in fact, if one looks at trends, after 2008, almost half your net new loans were mortgages. Now they're less than a third. In fact, the biggest loans today are for vehicle financing. And personal loans are as big as mortgage loans. So, you know, how do you deal with the balance? You don't want the same institution. It says, you know, for prudential reasons, they only give you 90% of a mortgage, but then also give you 10% as an unsecured personal loan. That should frankly be illegal. Okay. The same institution shouldn't be able to do that, because the idea is to only give you 90% of the loan for prudential reasons, if that's the reason. So I think there's a lot of issues about how they conduct their business. And I should add that there are conflicting objectives. So if you look at it, the Jali inquiry into bank charges made lots of recommendations. It said, for example, we should open up the payment system. So we did. But I think we opened it up too much, to anyone who lends. And in fact, they favor it. I think that in the bill itself, certainly from a treasury perspective, if you look at the household indebtedness issues, I think we need to look at the whole area of other dispute resolution mechanisms over and above debt counseling. So debt counseling is important as a role, but if you look at the scale, it just reaches a small number of those credit agreements that feel like trouble. One really does need to think in terms of millions. And so certainly when Cabinet discussed this, they've asked us to look at voluntary debt mediation because and at no charge, because as you know, if you do debt counseling, you've got to pay. And if you look at, I think the NCR has done some excellent studies, which are listed here, which kind of identify some of these problems. So it's not anything that's new, the Treasury is inventing. But I think the question is, whilst the amendment bill does deal with some of the problems identified, it doesn't necessarily deal with all. And I think it's important just to check understand if we are not dealing with certain problems, why not? I think the one issue that we've engaged with the NCR is, and our colleagues at TTI, is the need to focus and just protect the customer over all other players. When you look at the market conduct regulator, I think the issue would be that the market conduct regulator needs to focus on the interests of the customer and only the customer. Credit providers, debt counselors, financial advisors, PDAs are all meant to obviously service around the customer so that if their practices are dubious, we should have no hesitation in acting against them. There's always the problem, I think, generally with the financial advisor community, and I think debt counselors are a form of financial advice, a necessary one, particularly since we don't have an insolvency mechanism to deal with people at the low income end who run into problems. As I came in, we were talking about debt restructuring. The NCA Act doesn't, according to these studies, allow for debt to be reduced. And that's where we would say that on a voluntary mechanism, we've been engaging certainly with the major lenders and saying that some of their loans have been to some extent reduced, but nobody's going to admit that. But we've asked the industry, we've got a huge problem here. Are they willing to take a haircut, a small haircut, and either give up some of the exorbitant penalties and fees that have been imposed to make the debt even higher? So I think those are important issues to engage. One's not blaming any specific lender, but one saying, can they come up with a systemic solution which can instantly bring relief? I think that if you look at the current system with debt counselors, it's obviously okay for people at a slightly higher income end, but your low income, people can't perhaps pay the debt counseling fees, and you'll see according to these studies that that's the area where very few people actually get effective debt counseling. So I think, Chair, that there are gaps here in our system, and it's quite important that we find a way for poorer people who are overly in debt to see how we can actually assist. And Cabinet has in fact taken this issue very seriously, and in December, in fact, went far beyond what we had been asking Cabinet. I mean, ministers were particularly critical of payday lenders, as I've said. And as I said, that's just following the trend. Look what's happening in the UK, Australia, etc., with regard to payday lenders. In fact, the bizarre thing is, if you want to save in South Africa, you have to be FICA compliant. It probably takes a day to open an account, etc. But to get a loan, some of them boast that they give it to you in 10 minutes. Affordability is not really looked at. And those guys should really take the hit. And a lot of their loans, if certain to me, quacks like a duck, flaps like a duck, it it's a reckless loan by any definition. And I think that we would ask the NCR to be extremely tough and brutal and act immediately when such loans are made. And in fact, we need to look at our fit and proper standards and, if necessary, put payday lenders in a separate category and ensure that they're not allowed to basically cause such social economic chaos in the way they conduct their business. And I think if one looks at it, and I'm not going to go through all of this because I think you've seen all of this, but all our regulators, if I look back to be critical, were not tough enough 5 years ago, in the last 5 years, because if they were, the over-indebtedness problems could have not been as bad as they are. We could have had higher loan-to-value limits. I don't want to blame any of the regulators, but I can name names. But this is wisdom in hindsight, Chair. Okay. We're all very clever updates, so I don't think it's fair to criticize the regulators for not doing this, because they were under pressure for loans to go up. If you were the party pooper, I promise you many of them would have lost their jobs. Okay? People would have said they're sabotaging the economy, they're not giving loans to poor people. So it's very hard to stand against the tide. But in retrospect, of course, there's a lot of wisdom. And next time there's a crisis, I think we should at least learn some of these lessons, as you see in the last bullet. So Cabinet has approved very tough measures. It's asked for a joint approach between TTI, Treasury, Department of Justice, and all the regulators. It wants us to look at what measures we can take to assist currently indebted households, what steps can we take to prevent future problems. It's taken a tough line on emolument attachment orders and garnishee orders. And Chair, I should say, the other big scandal are the debt collection firms. Now, while many of them are regulated, legal firms are not. And in fact, the legal firms are the biggest transgressors, and I think that the law societies, I'm not so sure if they really are geared to act. I mean, these are guys who just focus, they phone you 50 times a day, they're not supposed to blacklist you. Most people should just tell them, give them a two-word answer. Because why should you even deal with them? You should deal with your, if the source at which you took out the debt, retail level should certainly have some sort of approval. So this certainly needs to be regulated, and we've been told to work with the Department of Justice and make sure that this applies to the legal firms. And I mean, I don't have to tell you that you can read almost every day there's articles about them, whether one's an Atlas or whether it's, you know, this or that. Lots of these names pop up. Of course, the problem we have, Chair, is that
looking at, and unfortunately I'm not sitting in the right chair here, is just to look at our time. It's time for the committee just to clarify a few things. So really, can we just give you a few more minutes?
Okay, to wrap up? I think I've made most of my points. So I just wanted to alert you that Cabinet has instructed us here as officials to come up with a very tough plan. So you should ask us very shortly, where is the plan? It's going to be tough. If you're a payday lender, you're not going to be very happy. Certainly, these are the types of proposals that we're looking at. We have been talking to the industry. Some of them are willing to come forward and take pay cuts on the reckless loans that they've, or the dicey loans that have been out previously. So I think that there's a lot that we could do, and I'm not going to go through all these now, given the time. And I think I just want to end by saying that, of course, linked to you know, a good example around credit abuses have been that not only do you get a loan, but you're asked to take out credit life insurance, which is exorbitant. Now, that gets regulated by the FSB insurance. Loans by the NCR, they don't work together to have a joint approach. You're not going to regulate that. Some people think you should ban them. I may be one of them. I don't think they should be linked to credit, but we're not going to ban it, we're going to engage with the industry, but there needs to be good arguments to say why they shouldn't in fact not be allowed, because the actual claims ratio on that insurance is extremely low, and a lot of your companies, whether in the furniture industry, etc., are reliant on these practices, and they are disgraceful practices. So I think, Chair, just to end, and the last point, I think that for us, getting the retail credit market to function more effectively is important. There are some issues we have with the cleanup of data. Largely, we would support the cleanup of data, I think, and to remove court processes, especially when you're dealing with the low-income and when people can't pay. Because in a sense, the current system is not very functional. However, we think that we need to be very careful how we move to remove adverse information, particularly for those who haven't paid. Because what will happen is you will get a situation where even lenders won't be able to assess that the loans are reckless. And so I think this might seem a popular move, but it would actually act against the people who have good credit records, and they will suffer much more compared to where they are. So we certainly think that this cleanup is necessary. We certainly think that credit bureaus need to be regulated more effectively. I think that they do have a reasonable code of conduct, but I think much more could be done. But I think that's a separate discussion that we would like to engage with. So to conclude, Chair, I think we feel certainly strongly that, and we were consulted, and we must thank DGI if many of our suggestions were taken into account, that the amendments are in the right direction. We do pose a question, however, is do the amendments go far enough? There are some issues that we do have some concerns over, and Chair, we could give you a written thing in terms of clause by clause where we have issues, but by and large, I think we think that it's a big step in the right direction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DDG Maloniat. That has been quite enlightening, and for other stakeholders who are here, we allocated this hour to Treasury, so we still have 15 minutes for ourselves to clarify and raise a few questions in this regard. And it is heartening to know that within government itself, and there is this strong decision to work together, as it were, particularly on these pertinent pieces of regulation and legislation. So over to the committee. I've shifted to this direction because that mic is not working in every respect, so we're not trying to play musical chairs. So I see there a hand at the back. I think it's Honourable McIntosh. Yes, Honourable Swanepoel, Honourable Hill-Lewis. Am I correct? And I know, Honourable Kabal, you've just walked back in, but you did want to raise some questions yourself with Treasury. So if you'd like to come in after the others then. In that order, please. And if we can avoid the prefaces, I try to keep my little input down to 2 minutes. Please, will you do the same? Thank you. Honourable McIntosh.
Madam Chair, thank you for Mr. Momoniak's presentation. We've got used to his compendious knowledge and contributions. The one thing I should tell him is he was looking for two words to give the lawyers who come collecting debt. There's actually an acronym for it. It's called FO. But one of my concern with this presentation and in fact the legislation, and it's a dilemma for any legislator, and it's in terms of human liberty. If people want to borrow money, they will find a way, and in a sense we're concentrating quite rightly on people who know more, like the banks and the micro lenders and everybody, but Certainly, I don't know whether I look like a sucker who's got money to lend, but if I was to tell you the requests I get for loans, even within this parliament, from people, and it's the reality is there will be a bigger group of what we know exist in your informal civics, your townships, what we generally call mashonisas. And so that is a concern that I've got, is educating the consumer. Now, there's no emphasis at all so far in the Treasury's presentation to say, look, we've got to get out there, and there's got to be a module in our high school syllabus which says budget. How do you run your budget? How do you spend your money? What do you do? And I would just feel more comfortable if there was a recognition that it's not just the lenders who are doing bad things, but it's the borrowers who are very irresponsible in many cases. And how can we educate them to understand what the implications are of debt? Thank you. Sorry, one specific, very specific question. The Financial Stability Board, as I understand it, our Financial Stability Board, and we could have a SIFI, a D-SIFI, it's now called to get these acronyms right, with our four big banks. But as I understand it, our Financial Stability Board is going to be subject to review by IMF in the FSAP. And that's my question. Do I understand that correctly?
Thank you very much. Honourable McIntosh, Honourable Swanepoel.
Thank you, Chairperson. I found the presentation extremely useful. Thank you very much, DDG. Just the one process question I want to ask you. You spoke about the Twin Peaks legislation, which is currently being... it's out for public comment. And you also said it called for the need of synchronization between the National Credit Act and these Twin Peaks Acts. But now, one has been out for comment, and the other one we're already starting to discuss. So my question on process is, have you yet determined how material the differences are? And what happens if we pass this legislation and then we have to come back to pass legislation again? So it's a question on how to ensure synchronization in the process, not just synchronization in the legislation, but synchronization in this process as well.
Thank you, Honourable Hill, Honourable Hill Lewis.
Thank you very much for the presentation. It's really very, very useful. And I look forward to also seeing your clause by clause document, which will be very helpful as well. I mean, just briefly a comment. I think the most important, first of all of the bullet points that you've raised here, it's very, very, I don't think there's one of them that I actually really disagree with. And I think it's important that we consider each bullet point very carefully in discussing this bill. Well, the second comment is to say that your presentation makes the point which I think we have to make over and over again in every forum, and that is that proper enforcement of good regulations is also a sine qua non for fixing the problem of over-indebtedness in the country. And of course, as the colleague has said, education as well. The final comment then is you've given something of a work agenda for the I think you call it the immediate term, the short term, and then the medium term. And simply to ask, What progress there is on that work agenda from your side at the National Treasury Council. I agree with the work agenda. I think it's exactly the key issues. And despite your obvious focus on the budget, is this something that the Treasury is pressing forward on a daily basis?
Thank you very much, Honourable Hill Lewis. I'm not so sure if there is any other member down there who wants to raise another question, because I see a mic still on. I can't see who the mic belongs to. Right. Right, Honourable Salam.
Just I've got hesitant to raise the challenge before us, mainly because it doesn't look like a challenge we can be able to solve overnight. The cooperation and coordination of the different authorities that are dealing with credit, it is a very big challenge, and one asks whether our process, as we have unfolded now, is not going to find itself at some time later, having not catered for the possibility of that cooperation and coordination with other authorities in the credit area. I find it very difficult. I'm not stopping us from moving on with this legislation, but I'm just cautioning that in a number of years to come, we will have to come back to the same legislation.
Thank you, Honourable Salam. I have one comment. It's towards the end of the question, please. Mr. Mamoni, it is here. Dealing with the pricing caps, etc., especially for what are called payday loans, where rates are excessive. It also came to my attention, and I believe this would fall directly under Treasury, I believe, that the ATM loans, 5,000, 10,000, if you don't repay them during the 30-day period that you take them out, because you can get them out just by putting your credit or debit card in, your interest rate can go as high as 51%. Now, I'm not sure how and why you should be able to take out these loans at such an excessive interest rate. We will, of course, also be raising that with the DTI, because I am aware that that isn't covered in the previous legislation, that small amount, if you like, small to me and you, but possibly extremely large to others who are unemployed or at a very low end of the market wage-wise. So it would be interesting to get a response there. The other thing is this whole national payment system where what are regarded as essential loans are dealt, are immediately paid by the bank. Whereas putting a roof over your head is not considered essential unless you're renting it. But if it's your own house, then it's not essential. So it comes after the cell phone, half a dozen other little things. Now, I thought that was a Treasury issue on the one hand. Related to that is the fact that money sits in the bank on public holidays and that sort of thing. But on the other hand, when the bank does want money from you, it actually works on a Sunday, the whole payment system. Is there something that Treasury aware of that? Because it's coming up more and more to our committee, this issue that the banks strictly observe public holidays except when we owe them money. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. I think just to start in sequence, I agree with Honourable McIntosh. I think that obviously there's no time to deal with all the issues, but education is extremely important, and in fact, the system is looking, we are looking at ways to get better education in the schools and after. But, you know, the essential problem is, you know, very well-educated people get caught by a tenant bomb, for example, okay? But there's something called greed, which kind of affects your nationality. So it's, or people are desperate, and they think, you know, they have an optimistic scenario of what they're going to be earning in 2 years' time. So these are very hard human issues. The no easy solution, but that doesn't mean to say that we don't have good education, and not just from the school system. In fact, financial institutions should and could do more to educate their customers. So it's when you take out your bond, your first bond, how much do you learn in the process, how much are you educated on the risks, and so on. Similarly, I mean, I know in the UK, I don't know how far it's gone, but you know, the funny thing is that as soon as people have to pay for a little bit of information, people don't do it. You know, they can take out a massive, you know, buy a house, but even if it costs 10 rand, they don't do it. So in the UK, they have a system where you can phone and it's free advice. On the other hand, let me say that we also got, we go overboard in requiring advice. You know, we've been saying that when somebody wants to save, and if you look at the financial sector, there's too many financial products. They compete on products, not on price. And for the low income market, middle income market, it helps to get fewer products. It is impossible to compare products. And that's what happened with the Jali Commission. They tried to look at types of banking accounts, costs. There's so many, they package so differently that it's very hard to compare. Now, we definitely need to put resources and get independent information on accounts using the NAT. So your question is not a simple question. I think it's going to need a lot of initiatives and take into account that perhaps we as human beings are greedy and that does cloud our mind, and how do you still deal with that? And it gets to issues of how paternalistic should the state be, because the person who wants a loan, and then they think later how they're going to pay it. I think that with regard to, it's not just the Financial Services Board, the FCEP is designed primarily around looking at the Basel commitments, so they look at banking, they look at insurance, there's a basic standards there, and they look at IOSCO, the security standards. And then they look at the entire financial sector now. They are looking at stability of the situation. So they look at specific issues. We are noticed, so we do have to get our legislation in quickly. But I guess they will look at the draft bill and look at what our intentions are. Honourable Swanapu, I think with regard to, you know, the problem with financial sector legislation is if you wait for it to be perfect, we're never going to get through legislation. We ourselves as a Treasury, I mean, we amended 11 of our acts, which has got signed into law, and we had to do that to align with the Companies Act. The argument was, shouldn't we wait for this legislation? So I think that you somehow have to run the two processes together, because the financial sector is just too skillful at delays. And so let's legislate the things we can, knowing full well we never, it's not going to be necessarily fully aligned. In fact, what we are now doing with financial legislation, we're now getting a general bill to amend legislation every year. What used to happen is, if it's a Banks Act, it might get changed once in 5 years. So you know, if you identify a problem in year one, you wait till year five. It's not helpful. So I'm not saying this is a good solution, because that's how we deal with tax legislation, and frankly, I think we over-legislate that way as well. It causes its own problems. So the problem of synchronization is an important one. As I said, some of the steps I think that are there in the bill, I think, will be a plus, and for me, that should be a basis to pass it. I think the only issue is you want to pick up, are there potential big contradictions, perhaps, which you might want to pick up on, or could it go further, given what we know now, compared to when the bill was published? I think the other way to do it is, and I know Parliament has difficulty in this, but some of these things may even require joint hearings between committees, because one committee does this, another committee does this, is there a way for the committees to talk to each other, I think is an important point. You know, I mean, the big point out of the financial sector, the global crisis, was that wherever there are regulatory differences, you know, you're going to get financial sector players. And that's why you actually nowadays don't want to over-legislate, rather leave it to the regulators. So the regulators do have draconian powers. They can close a bank, for example. Okay. We do need to look at the issue of accountability of the regulators, because regulators are extremely powerful. They can affect your reputation if they act maliciously, for example. But having said that, you do need a competent regulatory authority. I mean, we find that if you take Basel III to Parliament, it's very hard, even for us in the department, to follow the technical detail that the regulators need to be into. It's very hard in Parliament. So we need to find a balance between giving strong powers to the regulators with the power to have subordinate legislation through regulations and what you have in terms of legislation. Honourable Lewis, I think on your point, enforcement is a big issue here, and in fact, especially when Mr. Arthur Brown walks away so lightly, it doesn't help. So even when we enforce, I think there's a real problem there, because for many, crime does pay, especially in the financial sector. So I think I would accept your point. In terms of the work agenda, I think, just very quickly, just on the indebtedness stuff, Cabinet only passed it in December, so what I'm giving you is what Cabinet had kind of said. It's up to people like Zorwa and myself to have a concrete plan, so perhaps give us about 1 or 2 months to have a full plan, but there are some things we can do. On the Twin Peaks, we've outlined this program that we have. Honourable Salah, just on the issue of the challenges of cooperation, that is actually, I would hope Parliament would always call all the regulators and check on us, that the regulators are cooperating. And it's not a South African problem. Everywhere, in the UK, they had the financial, now it's the FCA, but they had the FSA, and they had the Bank of England. They had MOUs, but that's still, the matter of fact was they weren't actually coordinating. And today, if you go to the international workshops, they have what they call supervisory colleges. So if you Barclays, all the countries that are involved where Barclays operates, the regulators come together. But when there's a crisis, even that may not be sufficient. So it's something that one needs to watch and punish regulators who clearly aren't cooperating. It should somehow be in a performance system that they are cooperating with others. And I think it's important to spell out that whilst operationally they are independent, they may need to change their mind, because you do something, it affects another regulator. In some cases, you might have to make joint decisions. And if there's if you can't reach agreement, you have a mechanism for coming to a decision, because you may have conflicting objectives, which are both right, but how do you actually deal with it? Last one, pricing caps and payday loans, Chair. I think your point on ATM loans are noted. You see, again, that would fall between NCR. The bank supervisor doesn't actually, the supervision department doesn't deal with it, and I think thanks to the Jali Commission, committee actually identified that there was a need for market conduct regulator. In fact, that has influenced us, because we think the blood of a central banker is not very good at assessing consumer protection. They're always going to be like doctors. They want to fix up the bank. They're not going to go after people who are transgressors. So hence the split. Even though there's potential for regulatory arbitrage between the two, but the point is, I think they look at, they're supposed to both view things differently, but we are forcing them to coordinate. So this is one of those things that could fall through the loops. think on the national payment system, that too, I think again, you know, some of the changes were made after the Jani recommendations, and I think, you know, the key point is the national payment system has had perverse outcomes. It actually favors smaller loans against, and that's wrong, so they aren't bringing changes. But I think, just to end, on all of these things, it's quite important when regulators change these things. They put out something for public comment, that because there's different best interests, but at some point you need to decide when you favor, or when you choose, what interest you're going to favor. Is a mortgage loan better than a vehicle loan or a personal loan? Because you can always find a personal loan if it's used for business, it generates income. You know, it's really, you've got to go on a case-by-case basis, so it's very hard to have to judge these things. But thank you, Chair.
It is a peculiarity about renting a house and owning it. If you rent it, no problem. If you own it, have a mortgage, then it's not essential. I think someone slipped up when they were tired reading it. Yeah. Okay. We actually want to close this part now because we need to move on to something else. But I would like to thank you most sincerely, Mr. Mamonia, for coming here, DG, one of the DGs of Treasury, but also to say this, that there will possibly be some other questions, and I know right now your priority is the budget looming, but we hope that when we put the questions together next week, you may have the opportunity to send someone if you can't come yourself. Thank you very much to you and your team. Thank you. Now, the next one is the Credit Providers Association. The Credit Providers Association, can they please come in here very quickly? And we're looking at Ms. Daryl Begum, Executive Director, Credit Providers Association. Right. Okay. Ah, you're right there. I thought you were part of Treasury. Thank you very much. It's over to yourself. I'm sure you can see that time is against us, but you've been incredibly patient, so please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon to you, honourable committee members, members of the public. I welcome the opportunity to engage with you, and I have a few points of clarity to make. We are called the Credit Providers Association. We are essentially a data facilitation association. So my comments will be couched around data and the importance of data more than the provision and management of credit, which other parties who will be presenting here over the next 3 days will address more fully than what I would in my presentation. However, I did think it would be relevant to share with you what the Credit Providers Association is about, who we are and how we operate, and also why data matters so much. For the parties who know me, I worked for the National Credit Regulator previously, and I spent 7.5 years doing research in financial access across Africa. So data is very much one of my passions, and I am that passionate that I would say to the committee, if it would make you hear my message more, I would willingly step down from my role. It is just that data is so important and it needs to be appreciated for what it is. I would also share with you how the credit world or the credit data world in South Africa currently operates and some of the challenges and opportunities that exist in that space. And then, out of all the concerns around the National Credit Act Amendment Bill, I've chosen really just to focus on the data because for me that is the foundation of all the credit management practices that can happen. And my intention for today's presentation will become abundantly clear as we proceed. So data is to financial well-being as what water is to life. That's my quote, that's my philosophy, and it's currently the philosophy that I use to manage the Credit Providers Association. And I am really serious about that, and I would like you to consider, even in your own life, any decision you've ever made without information. You actually cannot. You always need information for decision making. And that is essentially the role of credit information in the country. It informs a multitude of decisions. So who is the Credit Providers Association? We're a voluntary association of industry players who share payment performance information about their debtors, and the intention is to make the best possible credit and risk decisions. It is a not-for-profit organization, so we have no profit agenda, and I have no other agenda than the protection of data and the facilitation of data sharing in the country. We have a name change in progress, and that is because the CPA as an acronym often is confused with the Consumer Protection Act. And also because the change in the nature of the organization includes 25 years of existence. We started out as the Consumer Credit Association, where we did deal with credit matters. In our 25th year, what we focus on is credit data, not specifically credit matters. Our association participants are NCR registered credit providers, such as banks, microlenders, retailers, insurers, etc. Also non-NCR registered providers, utility companies are looking to become members, subscription service providers such as DSTV, MultiChoice, call tracking services, all of these parties could be members of the association. And service providers which support these entities in understanding the information also become members of the association. And very importantly, the credit reporting bureaus who actually host the information. And we deal only with four of the registered national credit regulators, national credit bureaus. And that is for the specific purpose of having credit bureaus that are able to protect the integrity and the standards of the data, because the volumes are large, as you will see as we move forward. So essentially, what is the CPA? It is a forum for credit information exchange. And I want to point out that in the National Credit Act, there is a definition of credit information. The information that we share, our members share through the association, is very limited compared to what could be shared. And my message has to say that we take the credit information that is shared really seriously. We protect it, we defend it, and we value it. But there's still scope for more information to be shared than what is currently. Currently, we share payment performance data. And we also share descriptive information about consumers, which actually helps identify the consumer's profile at the bureau when an inquiry is being made on the party. It's important to note, however, that none of our members deal with any information without the consumer's consent. So a consumer has to grant permission before their own profile can be accessed or used in any way for credit and marketing purposes. More importantly also is the fact that credit providers and our members who want to access data must have some preliminary information or some form of knowledge of that consumer before they can access information. So at the very least, they need a name and an identity number. And more importantly, the credit bureaus who host our data only allow access for the permissible purposes that are contained within the National Credit Act. So we are very serious about protecting the content, the quality, and the access to the data. And up on the screen are the purposes that the Act actually allows the data to be utilized for. And we make sure as best as we can, and so does the National Credit Regulator, that that is what credit information is being utilized for. I'm going to share very briefly something about how we operate, and the purpose of doing that is to demonstrate to you that we aim to be transparent, consistent, and very formal in our approach to the data. So we have specified data layouts, which our members must use to submit their data, and the reason for that is to ensure that we have a consistent flow of data in the same definitions, same descriptors, and that allows for better interpretation by the users of the information. Because, for example, what member A may regard as slow paying, 30 days or 90 days, another may regard as perfectly normal and not unusual. So we try to get a consistent view of the data by having particular standards. Positive and negative data is shared through our payment profile line, and that is the purpose of building a
comprehensive view of consumers. And I'm going to use myself as an example. October, November, December, if you look at Darren's credit profile, it wouldn't look as good as it used to. The particular bank that I used and the particular payment mechanism that I used from the bank had some technical challenges. So for 3 months in a row, I didn't pay on time. Fortunately, all the credit providers I deal with have my previous track record in terms of the 24 months window that's allowed to win the act. So if I do apply for credit now, those 3 months of paying late are not going to penalize me as seriously as what it might have if the data was missing. So in my instance, I have gold data up until those last 3 months, and then not such good data. But in the next 3 months, I'll be back to my gold standard. And I think one needs to be aware that debt collection companies, even when I worked for the credit bureaus many years ago, the concept of blacklisting something or somebody was a good way to get the consumer to respond and to be fearful. So if you don't pay, we're going to blacklist you. I think that is a concept that we need to kill in the country, and I said it very strongly. It doesn't bear the merit of what credit information is about. We have data reporting frequencies, currently monthly, for full debtors book in terms of payment profile data, and we're working on a 4-year project, we're halfway through it, for credit reporting to happen within 48 hours for all credit extended and all accounts closed. That is a world first. We have to take cognizance of the really good credit reporting environment that we have in the country. We operate on reciprocation principles, where to receive data, a company must offer data according to the standard and in the right formats. And we do censor members in terms of their data quality and the frequency of their submissions. That is the whole purpose of the association. We have agreed delivery mechanisms so that the data is not at risk or not at undue risk in terms of being transferred to the bureaus. And we try to tailor that to what is appropriate to the market. And the technology changes as the world of information changes. The agreed data quality standards, I tell you, I spend my life in constant negotiation with members to ensure that we're always improving the quality standards that we apply, and to look at other international practices to see what we should do and whether we've fallen short in any way. Certainly, when I worked for the National Credit Regulator's Office, we were part of the IFC's World Credit Reporting Standards workshops, and at that stage, and still today, we are compliant with what they propose would be good principles for credit data sharing. We have standard operating procedures within the organization to ensure that we don't, for example, benefit one member, perhaps a large bank, more than another member, perhaps a small lender. So why does data matter so much? And I think it matters because of the insights into consumer behaviors, which supports business risk assessment and risk mitigation strategies, not only for those businesses, but also for government. The very fact that we are having these hearings, that there's a bill that's proposing a review of the data, points to the knowledge that came out of the data that exists currently. If we didn't have that data, we would not have a handle on where the country is from a credit perspective. A particularly important factor for consideration in light of the youth profile of our population is what is called thin file customers, where there's very little information available about the consumer. This is important. The largest single segment of our population are people under the age of 35. It's also where the highest unemployment figures are and the lowest income is. And if we're going to bring these people into the formal economy and afford them opportunities to develop and grow economically and socially, we need the information on them. The credit information also affords the financial inclusion of more people, and research exists in this regard to actually demonstrate how many more people are coming into the formal credit market and the formal financial market. But there is a risk. If one looks at the last 2 years of the FinScope survey from South Africa, there's actually a growing number of people who are, again, depending on family and friends for their financial well-being and support. And that is a concern, because those people the same challenges as the people that are depending on them. And importantly, the small and medium micro enterprises are also able to access and extend credit, because typically smaller business is assessed in the owner's capacity, personal capacity. This benefits the business, it benefits their customers, and it does help create employment opportunities. The risk of removing information
I've put up there, and I hope that it's visible. This is an iterative cycle that all businesses go through, and one can start at any point in that circle. But typically, I like to start at the 20 past 4 position, which is where most companies would start. They would segment the market and decide who their target market is. They would then move into targeting the customer to attract the customer to do business with them. They would evaluate the customer and determine what level of risk is afforded to that consumer and what level of service and product and price would be afforded. They then go about acquiring the customer, disperse the money, and they have a relationship which relates not only to the collection of money but most often to upselling the customer over a long period of time. It is far more cost effective for a business to retain and grow a customer than to constantly access and acquire new customers. Collection happens whether one is a good payer or one is a slow or bad payer. Collection of money is due, and in the event that the consumer gets into difficulty, there is a rehabilitation cycle. For those consumers who pay up and finish one loan or one product, there's also the opportunity at the 10 past 2, almost 40 past 3 position up there of reactivating the relationship with the customer. Now the challenge here, and that's why there's a photograph of the hippo in the middle, is it's often not what you can see that matters. It is what is below. And when we consider the risks and challenges facing the economy and the credit market practices, perhaps it's not less information we need, but actually more. More information perhaps to distinguish between good faith customers and bad faith customers. There are consumers who will do their best to pay. There are also consumers who will not pay unless forced to. One has to be able to distinguish some way. So perhaps instead of removing data, we want to consider how to augment the data, because this is the cycle in business that needs to be fed. Up here is more information, and mostly because it is in your pack, so you have it. These are examples of what the information can be used to do or to create tools for. It's all about credit vetting, building up propensity models to anticipate and predict certain performances, tracing consumers, fraud identification and prevention, marketing, supplementing marketing lists, relationship management, debt consolidation, triggers and alerts. If I'm about to lose a customer, it would be good to know. Perhaps I can do something to engage more with that customer to retain the customer. It's cheaper for the consumer often and cheaper for the business to retain the customer. Employment vetting. The National Credit Act does allow for employment vetting under very specific and strict circumstances. My opinion that is the only time the data should be used is for that particular purpose, which says basically it is permissible at the time of recruitment for a position where a position of trust where the management of cash or finance is required. And that's the only permissible purpose of employment vetting in the Act. I think we should enforce it, not lose it. I certainly want a bank manager who is well capable of taking care of his own affairs managing my savings account. I don't want somebody who's in financial trouble because he just may find a way to help himself. The development of risk assessment tools, I mentioned the research and analysis, and I think this is something where South Africa is falling short. We do have a lot of statistical reporting that is shared with the National Credit Regulator, and they use it really well to create the Credit Bureau Monitor and also the Consumer Credit Market Report. But there's more analysis that can be done to properly inform government for policy purposes, business for risk mitigation strategies, and consumers in terms of how to be better at managing their credit. And then finally, but not least important, is the price or the premium setting. All of these functions are supported through the use of credit information and the sharing of credit information. So where did it all start? I can remember, and I'm giving my age away, in the 80s, I was not actually in the 80s, but I was then for a credit provider. But towards the late 80s, early 90s, I joined the credit bureau. And I can remember that the clients of the credit bureau would come to the office and discuss their debtors book. And for example, they would say, did you lend Daryl money? And the answer would be yes. Did she pay you this month? No, she didn't. Well, perhaps so, Lord, don't give her any more until she's made good. That has changed over time, and we have literally payment information shared on a monthly basis right now on 71 million accounts. That's a huge volume of data. And I want to say that within this Act, Regulation 17 allows every day an amnesty for South Africans in the sense that there are retention periods specified and the bureaus are diligent at removing the data once it's become past its due
think we need to take cognizance of the fact that there is already an ongoing amnesty or an ongoing removal of default data. And I think that works pretty well, actually. Currently, we are amongst the world's best credit reporting systems, as is referenced from the World Bank's Ease of Doing Business survey from a number of years back. It hasn't changed yet. We should be cautious not to affect it negatively without good benefit to the economy and the people. So where the data flows, business grows, consumers have options, government receives more taxes, and statistical insights which inform everybody in the situation. The statistics up there show you quarter on quarter for the various periods, the growth in credit active consumers, and the growth in the number of accounts, and the growth in the number of inquiries. And I've put it up there to demonstrate to you that in one quarter, 357 million decisions have been made using the credit information on the database at the bureaus. When we limit the information, we limit decision-making capability. But where the markets grow, we have a challenge. It was touched on earlier by a memo, and that is where the Consumer Financial Education is at. And I like to use this category of information, which comes from the Credit Bureau Monitor, published by the National Credit Regulator, and records the number of profiles that consumers have accessed. In other words, I, as a consumer, have gone to see my report, either free as a licensed app, or paid for if I've accessed it more than once a year. And if you recall the previous slide, there were 20 million credit active people in September, in the quarter end of September, but only 164,000 actually viewed their own credit profiles. That is what's wrong here, is that people don't know about the value of their credit profile. They don't know to go and dispute. Look at the number of disputes lodged. It's really low. Look at the number of disputes resolved in favor of consumers in regard to credit information at the bureaus. It's very low. This is part of what's wrong. We have a population who needs credit to survive. Top end, middle and top end, likes credit to survive because we like living well, but we're not financially literate. We're not clued up to what really matters. I included this just to show you what is happening internationally. In terms of global business information, it is doubling every 1.2 years. The data will continue to grow. Poor data costs between 20 to 35% in operating revenue. And I have a real life example of one of our members who delivers their particular product to their customers. And it's very interesting to note that 35% of their operating costs in their logistics department is spent on having to resend the product to their own customers because they had the wrong contact details, either phone number or address. So the gold in the data is really critical. And you can see the cost of poor quality data to US businesses, $600 billion per year, and to the economy, $3.1 billion annually. So we don't have figures for South Africa like this. I would have loved to have shared them with you, but we don't have them. It would be good to know what our data value is and what our cost of poor quality data is. The next three slides, I'm not going to read through for you. Other than to say you have them in your pack, and I included them just to give you thoughts around the relevance to the economy, to the consumers, and to the service providers of the credit data. So how credit operates in South Africa, we have data sources. They may be NCR registrants, they may not be. They could be public entities, the courts, for example. Those data sources' data goes into the bureaus. The bureaus operate and try their very best to be compliant to the National Credit Act. They submit reports to ourselves as well as to our members in terms of the quality and accuracy of the data that is submitted to them. And they also facilitate the consumers' access to the credit profiles and the ability to log disputes where they disagree with the information. And then last but not least, really important, is the legislation and regulation. So we have the National Credit Act. We have the National Register of Credit Agreements, which is being considered currently in terms of Section 69 of the Act. There's the FICA regulation, the POPI bill about to be an act, and the Consumer Protection Act. And that's probably not the end of the regulation. In fact, it's not a comprehensive bit. But I wanted to demonstrate to you that overarching all of this is the consumers and their interests and what matters to them.
I'm not sure if you're familiar with credit profiles or if you've ever looked at your own. I actually did a presentation once to a senior regulatory executive committee, not the NCR, to protect my previous colleagues. It's not them who I'm about to make an example of. But there were 22 senior executives in the room. And I asked them to raise their hands if they viewed their own credit profile ever. One hand went up. The chairperson of the committee said, I don't trade in credit, I always use cash, I don't need to see my own profile. And I said, how do you know someone else isn't using your name and trading in credit? And it's so true. We think if we can afford our way, we don't need to look at our credit profiles. We need to. It is part of your personal portfolio of assets. So this is the content currently of what's in a credit profile. The demographic descriptors, which is name, ID, date of birth, where you work, what your address is, and contact details. And that's used by bureaus to actually match the record to you. Otherwise, it's very difficult to find information about you. Logging of inquiries made by parties. The Act requires that people are able to see who accessed their profile. Payment performance, this monthly aging that we're talking about. Performance indicators, the one that everybody loves to talk about, which is adverse descriptors. Well, I know there's also a lot of positive descriptors. Public domain data such as judgment and dispute logging, if these exist, and debt counseling indicators. But perhaps that's not enough, going back to my point about what's allowed in terms of credit information or what falls within the definition of credit information. In an earlier conversation I was having with someone in the room, we were talking about the difference between bad faith and bad luck consumers. Maybe that's another indicator we need, because somebody who's willing to pay, got ill, lost their job, might be very different and needs be treated very differently to somebody who's refusing to pay until they've assumed. So the whole world of credit information relies on participation and reciprocation by big and small players. And there's benefit to all three of those parties. And the one party that I haven't got on that graphic, but I'm addressing today, is the South African government. Because it is through the information there that you actually understand what is happening in the credit markets. So some facts and a slightly different spin on it. 71.17 million accounts exist, 51.92 million are in good standing. Normally one hears about the number of consumers who are in adverse situation or adverse standing. I've consciously chosen to look at accounts, because if you took me as an example, as per my early example of late payments for 3 months, I would now fall in the adverse standing category. But actually, I'm fine. Credit profile fine and I have the money. So one actually has to look at the accounts to understand precisely what is happening. Adverse listings have stayed under 6% since December 2010. The highest ever was in the last quarter reported of 5.5%. I agree that it's growing. I agree that it's a concern. I do not believe that the removal of credit information from the bureaus is going to resolve that. If anything, it will mask it and will hide problems that need addressing. I've touched on it earlier, the unemployment figures. The rising cost of living. Have you looked at what it costs to buy a basket full of groceries? Have you looked at transport costs?
Yeah.
It is frightening. People who could afford the credit when they took it on can't necessarily afford it now through no intervention of their own or no overconsumption of credit. Simply the moving cost of living. There's additional expenses. I live in Gauteng. I pay an extra 450 rand a month now for my toll fees. I can't get away from it. I use the freeway to get to the office. It's just a fact of life, but it does mean I've got 450 rand less in my pocket. The younger population profile that I mentioned earlier, we have to move people into the economy. How do we do it? Not by masking the information on them, because from being thin files, they then become non-existent entities. And you've met me today, you have no idea. Am I worth 10 rand, 100 rand, or 1,000 rand? It's exactly the challenge that faces a credit provider when a consumer walks in. If there's no information, it's a mystery. When one looks at risk, the risk of what has been proposed around the removal of data will almost certainly result in credit contraction. And the related impacts of that on the economy and socially is scary. If we have people under the age of 35, largely unemployed, earning very little if they are employed, already involved in a service delivery process, and now we say, you may not access formal credit, what are we doing? I am seriously concerned. I think putting people into the informal market makes them riper for exploitation than if they stay in the formal market with the appropriate interventions. So my concern is, it's not the data. I want to repeat it. The challenge is not the data, rather what lies beyond it. The cost of doing business. You will hear in the next few days about my collective sector and the cost of doing business and how it's changed for them. Competition is in the market. The plum customers are oversubscribed by all service providers. It's a natural phenomenon of the market. We have to find a way to cultivate the less desirable consumer in terms of risk. And I say less desirable in terms of high risk profile. We have to find a way to deal with it. Consumer earnings are not increasing in line with the increasing cost of living, the low financial literacy that I demonstrated. And what falls outside the domain of the National Credit Act, how can we expect the credit regulator to deal with debt collection and all its issues, as Mimo raised earlier, in terms of legal companies, the fees they charge, etc. It is beyond the NCA's domain. And more importantly, what information is not reported and or available to both business and government in assessing where perhaps the challenges are? If you look at garnishing orders, a lot of the issues are reflected as adverse status for the consumer on the credit bureau, but the actual issue lies outside the credit market. It's in the collection space. So one has to look at the comprehensive picture. So wherein lies the remedy? I think understanding and augmenting the credit data, which should drive innovation in policy and business, it should inform policy and legislation, and it should enhance consumer choices. And we have to teach consumers to be more selective in what they do. I've sat in many focus groups with consumers through the years, and one of the statements that comes up regularly is, if you offer me credit, I'm going to take it. It doesn't matter whether I need it. If you offer it, I'm taking it. That's human nature. You offer me something that's going to make my life a little bit more exciting, a little bit more appealing. I'm going to think about the payment terms or the amount of money it's going to cost me at the end of the contract. I'm going to think about the pleasure I can derive now, and I'm going to take it. So we need to be aware of humans and what drives us. So what's missing from the data environment now? I think the categories of information that is missing. Imagine if you could take all the credit bureau data, do a spatial analysis, in other words, understand, for example, the credit profile of, let's say, Kai Richer, as an example. Then overlap that with what productivity is available in that space. What business is there? How much employment is there? Then overlap that with population size and population profile in terms of age, school going, employed, retired, etc. Would that not make a fantastically valuable tool for policymakers and regulators to actually manage the markets by? For me, it's about more information, augmented information, not less information. The obvious data that's missing to a large extent is debt collection data, debt counseling data, and business credit information in terms of payment profiles. Doesn't exist. So we need broader reach and contribution in terms of data by service and product providers. We need strong guardianship and custodianship of data in this forum, in business, by the consumers. It has to happen. The cognizance of the value and the role of data is critical. It is the tool that creates the insights that have got you sitting here today discussing the credit market. So my intention for today is to appeal to you to please take a closer look at what is planned. That elephant looking under the water is a very strong message. I think the South African economy could falter badly. It could actually end up on its face in the water if we're not careful. There are reports that exist, which I'll touch on in the next slide, that I think need to be referenced. To my knowledge, the DTI has not yet, and this was as of November 2013, has not yet conducted an economic impact assessment on the proposals around the data removal. That is a challenge for me. The data removal in 2006, I'm fully in support of. The industry hadn't been regulated in terms of credit reporting. The bureaus hadn't been regulated. It made absolute sense. This one, I'm not sure, makes any sense. So I'm appealing to you to please guard our gold. There are reports, the past CEO of the NCR has put out a report, the Personal Finance Research Unit of UNISA has put out an economic impact assessment report, and Moody's has warned against the removal of data and its impact on South Africa's rating internationally and the investor confidence. research reports from UNISA shows that effectively with the affordability guidelines as they were proposed last year, and I acknowledge they're not final yet, but as they were proposed then, combined with the removal of data, means effectively that people who earn less than 70,000 per annum would not get a formal credit. That's a huge number of people. Where do they go for their credit needs? It would also result in loss of employment. Anything between 60 and 114,000 jobs, they estimated. That's frightening. We can't afford to lose that. And the scary thing is, for me, is removing the data is not going to resolve the issues that have been raised as concerns. It's going to mask it and actually going to impede the access to formal, protected credit. I think I've probably said it all. I think that we should not lose the gold we have. The credit data is the gold. Let's enforce the Act. There's good provision in this Act in terms of retention, in terms of content, responsibility, and access by consumers. Let's make that happen.
Just before you switch off, if you can just make the reference, you did indicate blacklisting, etc., but also then you mentioned how valuable data is. I would assume that's data with integrity.
Yes, absolutely.
You didn't quite, I think it was somewhere here, but if you could cover that, because we're going to go on to the next presentation before we take questions. So just quickly deal with that, please.
Certainly. Remember I mentioned blacklisting is often a threat. In essence, all that blacklisting is, or credit listing, is the recording of payment or non-payment and the activity that the credit provider has adopted. For example, if I haven't paid for 6 months and they now choose to hand me over to a legal process for debt collection, they will record on my profile that they've handed me over. If they choose to write off the debt, you'll see my agent paid, paid, not paid, not paid, not paid, and then a W for write-off. So when we talk about blacklisting, in essence, we're talking about the end of the cycle where consumers are threatened, made to feel that they have to pay now to avoid being listed, when in actual fact they are being listed. The integrity of the data is critical, and that's what I try to demonstrate our organization's entire mission is to try and get members to submit data that is accurate, that is standardized, and that is reviewed. We do not have the regulatory authority that the National Credit Regulator has, so we do have a challenge around checking how accurate information is. In this sense, my 3 months where I paid late because of a payment system issue, that should reflect as paid late. I have actually checked my profile. It does show that it's paid late. So I'm assuming, at least for one example of one, the system is working. However, it is actually the role of the credit regulator to check that what the members or credit providers is reporting to bureaus is what they are reflecting on the statements going to the consumers and what is reflected in their debtors' books.
Thank you very much. As I said, we will be coming back to you to question Ms. Begum, but at this moment we're going to link